enjoying the day when we finally approached the frontier. I had been through this checkpoint dozens of times over the years. The field that marked the boundary between duchies was unremarkable, save that it had been a staging area for various armies. The one that was there now looked to be the combined forces of two baronies, I could see from their heraldry, by mage sight. Over 100 heavy lancers, and thrice that many archers and light infantry. Wains and logs had been piled up on either side of the road to create a barricade, allowing only a few to pass at a time. Crossbowmen peered out from behind emplacements, their bows cocked and ready.
"That does look intimidating,"
Tyndall smirked. "Clearly they've dealt with children before."
"Keep quiet," I counseled.
"Let me do the talking."
"I would not dream of depriving you of the honor, master,"
Tyndall replied, eyeing the three heavily mailed knights who were striding towards us with purpose. We halted within bowshot, bravely and patiently waiting parley.
"Hail! Who comes to the frontier of Castol?"
the lead knight asked, formally. "Minelan the Spellmonger, Baron of Sevendor," I answered promptly, displaying my ring seal. "And household."
"You have business in Castol?" asked the knight,
warily eyeing the long line of children behind us.
"I live in Castol," I replied. "I currently have business at Wilderhall with the royal court wizard, Master Hatterian." "And all of these people are in your household?" he asked skeptically.
"Of course not," I snorted. "Merely these folk here. The rest were travellers we met along the way."
"You met all of these people?"
"Our master is very friendly," Tyndall blurted out.
"Extremely gregarious," Rondol agreed. "Never met a stranger, from what I can tell."
I shrugged at the knight's glare.
"I like to talk," I confessed.
"Meeting new people on the road is always an adventure."
The knight was tired of our bantering, but my rank and the tension of the situation kept him from losing his temper.
"I am Sire Falgarch, representative of His Grace, the Duke of Castol. His Grace has decreed that no undocumented refugees be permitted entry into Castol," he said, loudly and evenly.
If he expected the Kasari to gasp in disappointment, he was the one disappointed.
"I commend His Grace on his devotion to administrative detail," I said smoothly. "So you understand that there will be no refugees crossing the border?" he asked, his voice growing even more tense.
"From what I understand, there aren't any refugees here," Pentandra said, feigning surprise.
That made Sir Falgarch snort.
"Then what do you call that rabble behind you?"
"The pilgrims?" asked Pentandra,
looking over her shoulder at the endless line of children behind her.
"They aren't refugees."
"Pilgrims?"
the knight asked, his mustache falling.
"Pilgrims,"
I affirmed, "which, under the terms of the Kingdom Charter, signed and sealed by the three constituent dukes, ensures that any and all pilgrims be permitted free access across ducal frontiers in pursuit of their religious devotion," I reminded him. That had been a serious point of negotiation, I'd learned. The only way the temples were willing to support the establishment of the kingdom was if their clergy were afforded special protections, and that covered the pilgrims that kept their temples running. Sir Falgarch was unimpressed.
"Real pilgrims," he corrected, "not vagabonds who say they're pilgrims. The charter states that only documented pilgrims on a pilgrimage to a recognized sacred site or precinct are offered those protections, not a bunch of landless urchins."
"From what I understand," I said slowly,
"each and every one of the pilgrims in this company has their documentation available, ready for your inspection and approval," I said, smiling serenely.
"What did you say?"
Sir Falgarch said, alarmed at the implications.
"That's correct, my lord,"
Brother Hotfoot said, pushing forward to address the man, a folio of parchment in his hands. He almost looked like a law brother than a road brother.
"Each and every person in this pilgrimage has the appropriate legal documentation supporting their right to cross the ducal frontier as designated pilgrims. The Kasari, I believe,
are headed for Kassar for the occasion of the installation and rededication of an ancient idol, sacred to their people, he continued, glancing at his notes. The rest of the company is headed to Lemsidden's? That is in Kassar too, isn't it? What a remarkable coincidence. Yes, the rest are headed to Lemsidden's in Kassar, to attend to the miraculous nun who can tell a man's fortune. A fortune-telling nun? Sire Thalgarch asked, confused and skeptical. Indeed, Brother Hotfoot said serenely. The Temple of Brigga, Charvelin Abbey, in Wilderhall, has issued an invitation to pilgrimage, in part to fund a new temple in the Kassari lands, to take advantage of the goddess' blessing, he said, handing the knight a parchment, notifying one and all of the officially sanctioned divine occurrence. The seal of the abbey was prominent across the bottom of the scroll. Ah, fortune-telling nun, Sire Thalgarch repeated, as if trying to convince himself. Aye, the ways of the gods remain mysterious, Hotfoot said with a sympathetic sigh. But each of these folk have their official letters of pilgrimage in hand, ready for your inspection. Each of them, Thalgarch asked in disbelief. Each and every one, Hotfoot assured serenely. One of the other knights could no longer be silent. That is ridiculous. It would take an army of clerks weeks to write that many letters, he complained, waving the notification around expressively. This invitation to pilgrimage is barely a week old. There is no possible way that each of these children, he sneered, looking at the column, has a duly executed and legal letter of pilgrimage. This is a wizard's trick, my lord, he insisted. No trick, I assure you, my lord, Hotfoot said solemnly. Every letter is very real. It has been written, signed by an authorized member of the clergy, and properly and legally sealed. The other knight spoke up, his face turning red with anger. My lord, he said in an urgent voice, the law specifies that such a pilgrimage must be sealed as well by the sitting lord of the land. Unless each of those urchins manage to convince whatever liege is still left in Alshar to do so, their letters are invalid. Why, you are correct, my lord, I said, continuing to smile. I was enjoying this more than I expected, but this blessed fortune-telling nun is an important and hallowed event, one which no man, whatever his age, would want to miss. A good lord seeks to facilitate the spiritual growth of his vassals and people, which is why each and every one of those letters of pilgrimage has been sealed by no less a personage as the Duke of Alshar himself. Sire Thalgarch openly laughed this time. The Duke of Alshar is dead, Baron. His realm riven. Baron Edmarin rules in Varone now. Lenguin no more authorized these so-called pilgrims than I gave my peasants a month off their rents for a good harvest. I was waiting for that. So was our guest. The gentleman on the horse behind me took off his nondescript war helm and revealed his face. Not that Thalgarch knew him by sight, but the way he did so indicated he contested the statement. To confirm his importance, he swept back his mantle, revealing the arms of Alshar, the famed antlers and anchor, surmounted by the ducal coronet embroidered in thread of gold on his surcoat, the kind of device only a sitting duke is permitted to bear. How forgiving of you to so richly reward those who toil in your lands, Duke Anguin said loudly. My lord, Sire Thalgarch struggled, unsure of what was happening. Thankfully, my staff was willing to help him. The proper form of address is your grace, my lord, Sir Festaren prompted smoothly, a bow or other courtesy as generally expected as well. Sire Thalgarch, I have the honour to present to you his grace, Duke Anguin II of Alshar. As an official of the royal court, I can attest to this man's identity, I said helpfully, as I bowed to him myself. Your grace, I had word that you were in Gilmora, enjoying the tournament season. As I was, Anguin replied smoothly,
though enjoy is a strong term, and yet here we are, the season waning, and I find myself growing bored of such amusements. I thought I might visit my good cousin, the Duke of Castell, since I was nearby Wilderhall.
I mean to say,
the man stammered, struggling to master the situation.
Are you saying, Your Grace, that you authorized every one of these pilgrims?
He asked, his eyes growing wider as the truth of the situation dawned on him.
Every last one,
the orphan duke pronounced with some satisfaction, and under the terms of the kingdom's charter, I fully expect any and all pilgrims presenting my seal to you on their documents for your inspection to be duly permitted entry and free passage to their destination for pilgrimage without fee or toll, else I would be forced to declare the royal charter in doubt, he said more forcefully. That would inevitably invite the scrutiny of my uncle, King Rad.
The royal charter, Your Grace?
Sir Falgarch asked, confused. If the royal charter is in doubt, well, warfare between signatory duchies would be permitted, would it not? Violations of the charter can be punished by any single duke if the others are not at hand to contest them. I would hate to have to enforce the charter by wiping out you and your men on the field of battle, Anguin added, with just the right menacing tone to be perceived as a warrior prince. He had been practicing, I could tell.
Your Grace,
one of the other knights said nervously, begging your pardon, but apart from a few archers, all I see behind you are nuns and children. Would you really order them to be slaughtered on our lances to try to enforce your wishes? We have our orders from our duke, he reminded us, who I heard from his very own lips insist that no undocumented person shall pass his frontiers, I agreed. Thankfully, everyone here has their parchment in order. In fact, I insist that you verify that, I said, a little forcefully, myself.
You insist?
The knight replied. I take no orders from you. Not in this matter. Clearly, you are trying to deceive us. We shall halt your march here until the prince himself has a say.
Prince or duke, you will permit us to pass as we are legally allowed to do,
Anguin replied, using his full authority for the first time. And you will do so at once, or be prepared to defend yourselves.
A broken duchy and a toothless duke, scoffed the third knight. Getting children to fight his battles because he has no one else. We've 600 men or more behind that barricade, and scouts report a large force moving up the road to reinforce us. Send your filthy Kasari and the rest of the rabble. We'll water Kasari fields with Al-Shari blood once again, he boasted triumphantly.
You should reconsider, gentlemen, I said quietly, because those reinforcements you heard word of are in fact the advanced elements of the Orphans Band mercenary troop. That troop accepted a commission as the personal guard of His Grace, Anguin, Duke of Al-Shar, 2 weeks ago, and are marching here to escort His Grace to Wilderhall. It's on their way. They just accepted a garrison assignment in Wenshar.
The Orphans Band,
Falgarch asked, swallowing. The Orphans were not perhaps the best-known mercenaries in the kingdom, but they were well-known enough as professionals, who weren't particularly thrilled with nobility in general. They also had a reputation for frequently decimating traditional feudal units in battle. To assist with my lord's deliberations, Rondal suggested, helpfully, I believe this unit of the Orphans is comprised of 2,000 hardened heavy and light infantry, he reported, as well as 3 auxiliary cavalry units they hired out of respect for their new employer's rank. Are your 600 men willing to stand against 4 times their number, with a force of archers and war magi behind you? He proposed.
I need to send word to her.
You need to prepare your men to read and inspect every single one of these pilgrims for entry into Castell, ordered the Duke of Al-Shar. That is the law, gentlemen, and no orders from your superiors are going to change that. You can either stand and do your duty as ordered, or refuse and bear my enmity. The The choice is yours. The final straw was Dara making a low pass overhead of our deliberations, all 40 feet of Frightful's wingspan on display for the knights. She flew low enough that you could smell bird. She screeched helpfully as she passed overhead, her shrill cry splitting everyone's ears. The wind that rushed past us when she went by blew his mantle into his face, and Sire Thalgarch had had enough. "Gentlemen," he ordered his men sternly, "prepare to inspect the pilgrim's documents." "All of them," he said with a sigh.
"But, sire," one of the other knights protested, "our orders were to stop—"
"I know damn well what our orders are, and I know what the law is. So does that man over there who is a seated duke. If the duke wants every parchment read and inspected, that's what our orders include."
"But it's a trick," insisted the shorter knight, shrilly. "They're wizards! They cast a spell and conjured all of those so-called papers. The king holds the Duke of Alshar's seal."
"Actually, my lord," Brother Hotfoot said smoothly, "that is not true at all."
He took a heavy gold signet ring out of a pouch and presented it to Duke Anguin with due ceremony.
"Thank you for the use, your grace. Blessings on you and your house for your attention to the spiritual needs of your subjects," he said, with just the right trace of humour.
"Ever shall I rule with the grace of the gods and the support of the clergy," Anguin said, surprised to see the ring his father had borne, the most important administrative symbol of his position. "Thank you for your keen attention to detail, Rhode Brother," he added diplomatically. "And I assure you, gentlemen, that every one of these documents is real, authentic, and in no way magically fabricated," I added. "You have the word of the spellmonger on that."
"There aren't enough scribes in the duchy to write that many letters,"
the skeptical knight, clearly a blindly loyal supporter of the prince, insisted.
"It has to be some magical trick."
"Ah, but there's where you are wrong, my lord," corrected Hotfoot, "for you see before you more than 2,000 competent scribes. The Kasari are all literate, believe it or not, and most can read and write as well as any clerk before they come to adulthood. Writing so many letters was merely an exercise for them, and a rather basic one at that. A couple of thousand sheets of parchment, a few thousand quills, 2 small barrels of ink, and it really didn't take all that long." He shrugged. "Now, shall I present my own documents first to begin the process? If we proceed, you may get to half of the trek by nightfall."
"Ah, I cannot read, Sire Thalgarch," the taller knight admitted to his lord.
"I'm sure we can find a 12-year-old to help you," Hotfoot said, smiling. "The Kasari are renowned for their helpful spirit. Or you can just witness the Duke's seal on each document to spare your poor eyes, and take our word for it."
"But we do expect an orderly and prompt crossing," the Duke reminded them. "My men are waiting beyond the frontier, and I would hate for such a belligerent, free company as the orphans get frustrated with waiting."
"Of course, your grace,"
Sire Thalgarch said, with a deep sigh of resignation. "I shall prepare my men to receive the pilgrims at once." And that's more or less how it went. Thalgarch had no more than 20 men among his 600 who could read, and whom he trusted to verify the documents. Brother Hotfoot speeded the process considerably by checking off each child on the roll, first the Kasari, then the orphans, as they entered Castal. With that many working, it actually went quicker than predicted. The last orphan came across to the cheers of the crowd on the other side of the frontier an hour before darkness fell. Most of our advanced party had already joined the orphans' band at the camp they had made in a meadow, hired from a shrine to Harris, 4 miles down the road. When we were all across the frontier, every last child, it was a cause for celebration. It was a merry gathering that night. The orphans had indeed been heading to Wensha by way of Wilderhall, in the hopes of picking up a late-season mission, or perhaps arranging a garrison assignment for the winter. When they had heard the particulars of my situation, and the nature of the refugees, they were very interested in negotiating a temporary contract. The amount of gold I promised had a lot to do with it, of course, but bold Ascus and the other orphans
were very protective over war's human debris. They had all been orphaned, one way or another, and all of them had seen what happened to those children whose parents died without support. They might have been mercenaries, but they were human beings, and human beings who were very sympathetic with the refugees' plight. The fact that their patron was known as the Orphan Duke had also struck a chord with the mercenaries. There was a camaraderie in the suffering of orphans I did not understand, but certainly appreciated. They had another reason for escorting us all the way to Wilderhall as well. They wanted to give some of the older lads the opportunity to enlist in their ranks. The Orphans' Band was a better billet for mercenaries than most, and far more egalitarian about pay and loot. Few lords took service with the unit, because they only recruited orphans. Finding a rich source of hale and hearty potential enlistees was a stroke of luck for them. A helpful additional advantage of the contract was that Duke Anguin now had his own professional military force, although only through midwinter, unless the contract was extended. They spoke of contingency contracts and retainer fees. We were still negotiating the details, and the orphans weren't looking to become anyone's permanent army. But they might serve a purpose when Anguin did eventually take power in what was left of Alshar. He would have some troops he didn't have to raise through feudal obligation. He just had to figure out how to pay them. The next day, those of us who were mounted broke camp earlier than the rest of the marchers and pressed ahead. "Why are we outpacing the Kasari?" Tyndall complained, as the vanguard of the Pathfinders disappeared around the bend behind us. "They'll never catch up like this."
"We have to make it to Wilderhall before they do," I explained. "We have an appointment there."
"With whom?"
Rondal asked, curious. "Spellmonger's business," was all I would say. They accepted that, like good apprentices, and didn't press. That was just as well. I didn't want any more argument from them than I anticipated. We had special company, after all.
"That was well done yesterday, Minilan," Duke Anguin told me, when he had ridden ahead to speak with me. "This was really the first time I've used my title to overcome a man. It was heady," he admitted.
"Get used to it, Your Grace," I counseled. "Before too long you're going to have to use power that way in order to reclaim your lands. If you don't act like a duke, people won't treat you like a duke," I pointed out.
"So I see,"
he agreed. "Well, I have you to thank for it. I feel less like a prisoner, or even an exile, and more like a proper lord. Do you think my cousin will really let me leave Wilderhall, if I come there unannounced? I think with 2,000 infantry behind you, he'll have to seriously consider just how well he could hold you if he wanted," I observed. "Besides, what legal basis would he have for holding you?"
"Threatening his summer palace with 2,000 infantry?" suggested Anguin with a grin. "I owe you much, Spellmonger. I cannot claim to have a throne just yet, but when I do take it, it will largely be your credit."
"You said when, and not if," I smiled back. "So, do you think you will follow my plan? After a summer on the tournament circuit, even running a broken duchy is better than the prospect of more pointless jousting."
"I've proven I'm no bloody good at it."
"Well, you are blessed then, Your Grace. In
Kasar there exists a woman who can tell you exactly what your life's purpose is. With any luck, it will have nothing at all to do with jousting."
Chapter 26 The End of the Trail. Those of us who had more urgent business in Wilderhall took to horse and rode ahead of the slower-moving march. Now that the orphans were guarding the orphans, I was less worried about Castali intervention. Brother Hotfoot borrowed a horse to accompany us, so that he could make provision for the encampment of orphan pilgrims and their Kasari guests, someplace near town, before they started the final leg of the journey into Kasar. Duke Anguin decided to ride ahead with me and my party, along with Landfather Amos, to pay a call on his dear cousin at his summer palace. The Duke tended to be quiet on the road. Rondal and Tyndall threw jibes and jests back and forth liberally, and Anguin didn't fail to smile at them, but it took several miles before the lad joined in the conversation himself. I got the feeling his restraint was born from inexperience, rather than innate shyness.
He had been tutored alone by learned monks, while most lads his age were engaging all manner of boisterous pursuits together. Anguin was quite willing to join in to the camaraderie of the road. He just didn't exactly know how. I took it as an encouraging sign. I found it even more encouraging that he was not just willing, but somewhat eager to confront his cousin, Tavard. Whatever enchantments I had performed in Alshar, the one that had convinced Anguin that he was no longer a prisoner, nor did he have to act like a hostage, was perhaps the subtlest, yet maybe the most profound. Without having to wait for the foot-weary marchers, we made excellent speed. 2 days after we set out from the frontier, we were back in Wilderhall. I was going to take rooms at an inn for a few days when Duke Anguin insisted our entire party stay at a spacious townhome he happened to own near the palace. Landfather Amos reminded him that one of his titles included the mansion, which had been sitting idle for years. It had been built by an ancestor who had enjoyed the hunting around Wilderhall more than Verone. I couldn't very well begrudge the Duke's lavish hospitality. That would have been rude. Once we settled in, we headed for the palace. It was still early enough in the day to conduct our business. Brother Hotfoot took his leave, as he needed to find an adequate campsite, but the boys were laughing and jovial as we headed to the castle, until we stopped at our destination. When I explained to them what I wanted them to do, they instantly got upset, but with some persuasion they did as they were asked. They were good lads, and as their task would take a few days, that left time for Anguin and me to track down the Prince Heir. As it happened, we were fortunate enough to find His Highness just adjourning a meeting of some of his vassals when we asked the herald to announce us. The servant was quite surprised by the titles and names he announced, as was Tavard, but the man did his duty. Tavard looked easily surprised by our presence and even less pleased.
"I've had word that you managed to circumvent my orders," the youthful prince said, dismissing his vassals and inviting us into his study.
"Not at all, Your Highness," I assured him. "No undocumented refugees were permitted past your frontier. I made certain of it.
Yet now a rabble infects my roads," he complained. "My vassals are alarmed and asking me to take action."
"They are pilgrims," Anguin pointed out. "All perfectly legal." That earned him a sharp eye from his cousin.
"Legal, perhaps," Tavard said, his voice a growl, "but not wise. I've consulted with His Majesty, and alas, there is little I can do about it," he said, with a note of resignation. "Apparently dukes who slaughter pilgrims aren't well thought of in some circles."
"I'll keep that in mind," nodded Anguin, his nostrils flaring.
"Yet dukes who support pilgrims are highly thought of, by the clergy and the people alike," I pointed out. "His Grace has begun his reign as Duke of Alshar by magnanimously approving and funding this grand pilgrimage to help ensure the future of our youth. It has been seen as a propitious sign of a long and prosperous reign," I lied. "I mean, it would be, once I made the rounds to some temples and spread the word, and some gold. The clergy do love a lord who looks to the spiritual welfare of his subjects."
"Which means if I do not do likewise, I will suffer in comparison," Tavard said angrily. "My father insists that alienating the clergy is dangerous, and currying favour with them like a lick-spittle courtier is the key to a good reign."
"It would be seen as a generous token of Your Highness's piety if you were to match your cousin's commitment," I agreed. "In fact, to be seen as brother dukes, investing equally in the future of the kingdom, the people love to hear such tales."
"A generous token of my piety," Tavard repeated icily. "No doubt it will. Yet though we are cousins, I am a prince, not merely a duke. Whatever funds you have provided for this madness, I will double the figure, if it speeds that filthy mob out of my sight."
"Your Highness is quite generous," I beamed. "I will inform your Chamberlain to draw up the letter of credit. And I will, of course, be sure to make it known far and wide how it was your idea alone to sponsor the pilgrimage. With Anguin's cooperation, of course. Not an unfair bargain for a mere 2,000 ounces of gold."
2,000 ounces?
Tavard asked, his face pale.
His Grace did pledge 1,000 ounces, I shrugged. Enough for the pilgrims to see themselves to Kassar and beyond. 2,000 will make that possible for many more now.
Your piety does you as much honour as your military victories, cousin, Anguin said smoothly.
I look forward to many future endeavours together. Our two houses united in the purpose of an enriched realm.
You,
Tavard said, his eyes narrowing dangerously.
Who do you think you are?
You've been a parasite on my family for 3 years now, and you repay our generosity and kindness with such deceit.
On the contrary, cousin,
Anguin said cockily, I have never been anything but a loyal vassal of your house, and a stalwart defender of my realm, he added, a touch of iron in his voice. Now that His Majesty has graciously acknowledged my majority and confirmed my investiture, I look forward to one day reassuming the rule of my lands. Until then, I'm grateful to enjoy the hospitality of yours.
Of course, cousin, Tavard said, pained and irritated, but wise enough to know that his rival was not easily bullied, not to his face. But as for you, Baron, he said, casting his bright eyes on me angrily, I think that after your business in Wilderhall is concluded, that you should see to your own lands for a while. No doubt they have suffered from your attention to Alshar this year. In fact, if I did not see your face out of them for a while, I find it would suit me well, he said through gritted teeth. I bowed. Your Grace is prescient. I was just speaking about such a reassessment of my priorities recently. As soon as my pilgrimage is complete and my business here done, I will retire to Sevendor as you ask.
Perhaps you've mistaken that as a request, Tavard said darkly.
Understood, Your Grace,
I agreed smoothly. May the gods continue to bless you, your bride, and your coming child.
Don't think this matter is settled,
Tavard said, dismissing us with a grunt.
Both of you.
We departed with a minimum of ceremony.
That went better than I expected,
I mused, as the Duke and I crossed the lovely bailey of the palace.
He didn't threaten civil war,
agreed Anguin, and he didn't try to kill either of us. In fact, he demonstrated a remarkable amount of restraint, comparatively.
Perhaps he is maturing a bit.
More like his father forbid any action, I proposed. Rad knew I was up to something, but he didn't push it. He knows I have the kingdom's best interest in mind. If I didn't know better, I'd think he was using me to keep his son in check.
Stranger things have happened in ducal politics,
Anguin agreed.
So, spellmonger, now that I have faced down my cousin, what do I do now?
Whatever you like, I said. But if I were you, I would plan on continuing the pilgrimage. I wasn't wrong about what I said to Tavard. That sort of thing gets noticed in places where you need to be noticed, if you're going to rebuild your duchy.
It's a superior course of action to finishing out the tournament season, he agreed. But it doesn't seem very ambitious.
Patience, Anguin, I counseled. If you want to do the wisest thing you could to restore your duchy, then I advise you to go to the White Bridge Inn and seek out an Alshari lord who resides there. His name is Count Angriel.
Count Angriel? To what end?
To play a game of charges, Your Grace, I suggested. I think you will find it quite instructive, and along the way, you may learn a few things of value about the man you play with. He studied me carefully.
This isn't going to be one of those times when you're actually just going to come out and tell me why I'm doing something, is it?
No, Your Grace, I chuckled. As I've said, wizards are known for subtlety and deception. But you've proven your intelligence. I have confidence that once you start playing, you will understand my reasoning.
Very well, spellmonger,
the young man said, nodding his dark head firmly. I have put myself into your hands, and you have not failed me yet.
I will go play some charges with this man, then, if you think it will be to my advantage.
I had one more bit of business the next day in Wilderhall. I left word for Brother Hotfoot to join me that afternoon at the Chavelin Abbey, without explaining why. Abbess Parsilly barely spoke to me when she saw me enter her sanctuary, but she had become used enough to my ways to immediately dismiss the novads.
"My girls are coming back," was all she asked me
an edge in her voice. "Safe and sound," I promised. "Their virtues mostly intact," I added, thinking of a couple of priestesses and a couple of Kasari rangers who had taken long walks a few times. While the priestesses were technically sworn to chastity, Brigga didn't worry about it much, from what I understood. And not all Kasari rangers had our born strength of character. They're only a few days up the road. "Are you going to call her again?" she asked suspiciously. "That's why I'm here," I agreed. "You need me?" she grunted. "No, not really," I decided. "Good," she sighed with disgust, dusting off her skirts and heading toward the inner sanctuary. "Nothing but trouble, you bloody wizards," she muttered as the beaded curtain closed behind her. "Run this place right. We could, if it wasn't for the bloody gods." I killed time studying the fire, reminiscing about my recent fever dream and its unlikely result. I actually welcomed my house arrest by Prince Tavard. It would give me ample opportunity to study the thing. Something that was Moloparish sounded intriguing and fascinating, and I couldn't wait until this quest was over, and I could go home and enjoy my punishment. About 10 minutes later, Brother Hotfoot entered. Despite the coolness of the late summer day, the monk had beads of sweat on his tonsure. "What can I do for you, spellmonger?" he asked gamely. "Did you find a spot to encamp the marchers?" I inquired. "Oh, yes. A big temple to Orvatus, just north of town," he agreed. "They've got 2 big meadows they aren't using for anything more pressing. I got a good bargain on it, too," he added, pleased with himself. "So why did you want me?" "I wanted the chance to thank you for all of your hard work and dedication to the march," I said warmly. "I could not have done it without you. And I do not say that lightly." "It was my pleasure," the monk dismissed. "Really, it's been a magnificent adventure." "That doesn't mean that thanks are not in order," I countered. "When such great assistance comes unlooked for, one can only suspect the gods themselves are involved." "And some of us are," came a familiar, if unearthly, voice from behind me. "Sorry," Brigga said, not sounding sorry in the slightest as she materialized in front of the ceremonial hearth. "But I got tired of waiting for you to invoke me." "You have no sense of the dramatic," I sighed in disgust. "Brother Hotfoot, may I present Brigga, the Narasi goddess of fire, magic, poetry, inspiration, smithcraft, magic, baking, fosterlings, vengeance. Am I leaving anything out?" "A couple," she shrugged. "You got the major ones." "And, Brigga, this gentleman happens to be Harris. Narasi god of travellers, messages, crossroads, thieves, commerce, magic. Am I missing anything?" "Gambling, liars, storytellers, benevolent assistants, shoemakers, and a few others," the monk acknowledged reluctantly, instead of being scandalized by my blasphemous accusation. "Actually, we've met a few times. So, what gave me away?" "A couple of things. First, there was just happening to find someone who could sell us 10,000 leaves of parchment," I offered. "I knew a guy," he shrugged. "And then there was how smoothly the march went after you joined. Far too smoothly. We didn't have a tithe of the deaths I had anticipated, nor disease. And don't tell me your visitation didn't speed us along our way faster than mortal feet would have carried us. I've been in a lot of outfits, Harris, and you simply don't move that many people, that many miles, that effortlessly. Not even with magic." "We had divine help," I accused. "Was I supposed to just let you stumble through on your own?" he chuckled. "People moving is my business. That many people moving to purpose, with that much magic involved, nearly guaranteed I'd be summoned somehow, eventually. But even that could have been coincidence, or sheer good luck. I tried to retire to the one village in the duchies that was destined to be the first to fall to a massive goblin invasion," I reminded him. "I don't have that kind of good luck. Not like that. And then, in my dreams, when I was ill, you appeared and helped me in a tough spot. You were the only other one, besides Brigga, who wasn't killed or maimed in some horrible way due to my mistakes. I suppose I started to really suspect you then.
I barely know you personally, and that was just far too vivid and real to be pulled from my own mind. It had to be divine.
I needed to help guide you back to life, Harris agreed. Thanks to my sphere of control, that's under my purview. Well, I hope no one else figured it out. I took great pains to be a simple monk, this manifestation.
But what sealed it, so to speak, was stealing the Duke of Alshar's signet back, I explained. There was no way a mere mortal thief could have done that, not without some professional help, some divine help. Not from the hidden treasuries of Wilderhall, those awarded by very, very tough magic. In addition to locks, gates, bars, doors, walls, I have a co-religionist at the palace. He shrugged. He owed me a favor. I'm sure you do. And I owe you one now, I told the monk. Or rather, I owe Brigga one.
One?
My goddess said with amused skepticism. And I am quite happy to pay it. I was curious when you mentioned something about a favor. I have developed the capability to ensure the permanence and auto-sustainability of the enneagrammatic pattern that maintains its cohesion as a unique iteration of its divine nature, I explained. I'm a god of peasants, magic, he reminded me after a few moments of confusion. Dice, finding lost coins, that sort of thing.
He does that all the time,
Brigger snorted. Assumes everyone else knows what he's talking about. Then he has to explain it all again in plain language. He thinks it makes him sound clever. It comes across as a bit pompous. You'll get used to it. Ouch. I thought that was a little harsh for divine judgment. So, what does he mean? The god of travelers asked.
Harris, he can make you, this iteration of you, permanent,
Brigger said. A little excitement in her voice.
That is, when you discorporate, you'll be able to retain your present memory and have conscious control over your form. You'll have continuity of experience, she explained. You won't have to introduce yourself to the other gods all over again, each time you meet them. You can do this?
He asked me, surprised and a little shaken by the idea. I did it for Brigger, I agreed. It's actually not hard, if you have the stones for it, so to speak. So far, it's worked out pretty well. For everyone but her priestesses, I amended. Are you interested, Harris the hot-footed?
Oh, I am,
the divinity agreed, breaking into a big grin. You have no idea how much of a relief that would be, especially for me. I manifest quite a bit, and re-establishing myself all over again takes time and energy. Oh, I knew it would be a good idea to materialize when you invoked me.
Wait, I invoked you?
I asked, confused. Well, you did name a tower Traveler's Tower, he reminded me. You built a shrine there. You made an offering and invoked me. I'm not picky, like some divinities I could name. That's all of the invitation I needed to harness the collective energy of everyone in the march and manifest. Each additional marcher brings me more power and control, as long as we keep going. So, what happens when we reach the end of the road? I asked, curious. He shrugged. Usually I just fade away until some other traveler needs me. But you're suggesting I may actually have control over that now.
Oh, yes,
Brigger agreed happily.
You'll love it, little brother.
You two are related. You learn the oddest things on the road.
She's my half-sister,
Harris agreed, blushing a little. Different mothers. Dad got around. What other divinities have you done? He asked, changing the subject. Could the gods get embarrassed about that sort of thing? Apparently, yes. Just Brigger, I admitted. I'm being kind of choosy, actually. But it's not like I come across gods every day. I figure I'll use the same sort of standard I use in gauging whether a man is ready for a witchstone. Are they dangerous? Do they have control? Do they piss me off?
If I happened across a promising one, would you consider it? Harris asked, chewing on one finger in thought. I get around a bit.
I actually ran into more of them than most, because of my sphere.
I would be happy to consider any candidate you thought worthy, I promised, taking the stone out of my pouch. Though I have a short list of questionable gods that I might refuse on general grounds.
I assure you my list would be longer, Harris chuckled. I know more gods better. But if you do this, he continued thoughtfully, I think it will be the beginning of a very important relationship,
one that would assist both of us, he said, catching Brigger by eye, in the fulfillment of our mission. My turn to snort.
The gods have a mission.
Oh, yes, Brigger eagerly agreed. We're here to protect humanity.
From what?
Each other.
From the rest of this world,
Brigger supplied. Kalador is a dangerous place, even more dangerous now than when humanity first arrived. This world has tried to make you extinct repeatedly, but with the help of the gods you have persevered. Survived, at least, when the odds were against it. Our mission to guard you has been a qualified success.
So, if the gods have a mission, who gave it to them? I asked, confused.
You did, Brigger pointed out. We spring from the collective minds of humanity, manifesting when the need is greatest. That means the gods change and adapt as humanity is forced to change and adapt. But our mission is always the same. Protect and guide humanity on this world. Considering the powers we contend with, we're not always successful.
Not even mostly, Harris agreed, sourly. We can manifest, do some impressive things. But then, when we fade away, well, to be honest, your folk usually screw it all up again, he sighed, frustrated. Every now and then someone will come along who understands the greater picture, but for the most part, well, if you have any issues with the divine, then start by blaming the human minds who brought us into existence. If we're sloppy at our jobs, it's only because you're sloppy with yours.
That's helpful to know, I agreed, and it gives me some ideas, especially considering the big, glittery snowflake I now have in my cellar. Making more of you permanent would be in our mutual best interest, I understand.
Then also understand that if we are to do so, we must proceed with the utmost discretion.
Harris nodded sagely.
The powers who would oppose such a move to strengthen our role and our ability to defend humanity would be threatened by it. Best we move cautiously, quietly, and with great deliberation.
A secret cabal of gods and wizards, snorted Brigger. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, this will be great fun,
the god of unforeseen adventure said, clapping his hands eagerly.
All right, shall we get started?
I asked. Because those kids will be marching up that road any time now, and once they arrive, we aren't going to have time to get anything productive done. I almost wished that things were more exciting after Wilderhall, but the fact was that the rest of the march into the Castali Wilderlands was relatively uneventful. We faced no goblins, no angry local lords, no natural disasters along the way to deter our course. The road from Wilderhall to Lemsiddens was peaceful and lightly travelled, and quite well tended until we reached the depths of the Wilderlands. There were inns along the way, and alehouses. It was not a difficult journey. The weather cooperated beautifully, and a warm, fairly dry late summer watched over us as we made the last few 100 miles in remarkable time. There were few accidents, few illnesses, and no deaths. Of course, our divine shepherd may have had something to do with that. There was a certain excitement, mixed with poignancy, that took over the march as it reached its conclusion. Brother Hotfoot enjoyed the last few days of our journey, with songs and stories every night, around as many campfires as he could visit. The transformation of the children was remarkable. The 2,000 Kasari who had begun the journey had prospered along the way. 3 months of exhausting exercise and good food had caused many young lads to fill out their shoulders, while the young women who made the journey had developed exceedingly strong limbs themselves. They had found the march enriching in many ways, they told me as we made the last leg of it.
I made a point of asking many of them about their favourite parts, and even asked them all to write an account of their journey for me. The refugee children of Alshar had prospered even more by comparison. The ragged, scrawny little urchins from Verone, or the forests of the uplands, or the ruined villages of the penumbra, had gotten stronger under our care. Kids whose bones could be seen through their skin when they'd first made it to our camps were now well-muscled and fit, still skinny, for the most part, thanks to all of the walking with a load, but not unhealthy. Some of them had been half feral when they'd chanced upon our march. Their parents were dead or taken, or merely lost, and they had struggled to survive harder than the adults. They'd frequently been victims of betrayal by their own kind, as well as hunted by the Gavani. Yet now they walked proudly, spoke confidently, and acted like real boys and girls, not half-wild animals. Their skills had certainly improved from when they'd started, including social skills. The desire to belong, to be a part of something, had infected the refugees like a sickness. The refugee kids' eager enthusiasm to be included had made some of them even more adamant about the Kasari ways than the Kasari were. By the time we were down to the last 30 miles to the frontier with Kasar, in the beautiful midst of the gently rugged Kastali wilderlands, nearly every child, no matter how new to the march, struggled to make themselves into Kasari as best they were able. Many had little understanding of the meaning and significance behind the costume, but they put on neckcloths and fashioned brooches of woven rope, and borrowed needles to stitch wild patterns into their clothes in imitation of the complex Kasari embroidery. The feeling of expectation was growing daily as we approached the forested foothills where their most sacred groves were contained. Everyone wanted to be ready. For their part, the Kasari were ready. It had taken a lot of negotiations, with Arborn riding ahead and meeting with the council elders, but they had reluctantly agreed to take as many of the children into the camps as wanted to come, if their upkeep was paid for. I'd made that pledge without properly knowing how I would fulfill it, but with the gods on my side, I was hopeful I'd figure out something. After the rigors of the march, just paying for something seemed lavishly decadent. It was hard to believe, but one morning dawned that would be the last of the march. The brass horns that had wakened me every morning in the field sounded for the last time. It was misty and cool during inspection, with the first full gust of autumnal winds blowing from the west, but it was still warm enough to be pleasant. Every child in my patrol had done everything they could to show themselves the perfect Kasari. They wanted to put on a good showing when they marched into the only real town the Kasari had. They were nervous, which was adorable, and I spent my time during inspection lecturing them about how proud I was of their achievements over the summer. I promised everyone in my patrol that they were always welcome in Sevendor. After I made my tent disappear into my staff, I made a quick trip back to Sevendor to retrieve Alia and a few other interested parties while my patrol got into formation on the road. I was bringing Gareth, for one. The lad looked positively exhausted after his long and harrowing stretch as our manciple, but I praised him profusely for his efforts and his dedication. He may not have been slogging along with us, but he had been there in support of every step we took. He deserved to be there at the end of the trail. Alia wanted to be there in support of me. Her occasional visits to the camp along the way had been a kind of novel holiday for her. They also gave her an appreciation for the magnitude of the task I was attempting. She wanted to share my victory with me on the last day, and I was thankful for that. It was a joyful and tearful morning with my patrol, and once breakfast was served, one last time, we were ready to make the last leg. We were 3 miles from the frontier and 10 miles from the Kasari town of Lemsiddens. We'd be there by noon. The feeling of excitement mounted as the kids realized that they were at the end of the journey. It grew even more as whispered tales of the miraculous nun that lived near the town's outer precincts spread. She had been telling people what their truest talents were, and it had been changing lives. The exact nature and purpose of her pronouncements wasn't always understood by the unsophisticated mind of the children, but they were all very excited about speaking with her. The last morning's march was almost like a military parade. The hempen uniforms of the Kasari were revealed under their thrown-back travel cloaks. The
The staves of thousands of adolescent pilgrims helped keep the lines orderly as we marched. Each troop, and there were 12 formal troops now, and dozens of informal ones, did its best to show off their precision as we marched up the last hill toward the town. For the last few miles, the troops belted out their favorite marching songs. Each troop competed as they marched to sing the loudest or the most beautifully. They were mostly loud. I marched the whole way, the most walking I'd done since my illness, Alia on my arm and trail blazer in my hand. I felt good, though I was still a bit tired. Just as we began the final leg, hoofbeats came up from behind us as Tyndall and Rondell joined the head of the group. They both looked solemn and disturbed. "It's about time you two showed up," Dara complained from the third row back, where she marched next to Sir Festaren, frightful on her shoulder. The rest of her wing was making lazy circles overhead, in honor of our Kasari hosts, but Dara wanted to walk the last bit herself. "I'm almost afraid to ask what took you so long in Wilderhall. Were they pretty?" Rondell ignored her. Tyndall slowed his mount to a walk next to our column. "We had business," he said simply. "Now it's done." "What kind of business?" asked Sir Festaren. "I thought that we had everything we needed for the march." "Personal business," Rondell answered gruffly. "Nothing to do with the march." "My, isn't that mysterious?" Dara continued, clearly feeling sassy in the excitement of the day. "I can't wait until I'm senior apprentice and can be intriguing like that." "You don't have to," Tyndall said, with the smallest of smirks. "As of now, you are senior apprentice," affirmed Rondell a little grimly. "What?" Dara asked, her eyes wide. "What happened?" Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondell both sat for their certification examinations with Master Hartarian while they were at Wilderhall, I explained to my remaining apprentice. The Royal Court Wizard was quite happy to extend the special consideration to me, as well as administer the tests personally.
"Min, that's a big step,"
Alia said, finally recovering from the shock.
"You had them sit for their exams."
"It was past time to let them be their own men," I answered. "This march was their master's demonstration for me, but I saw enough to know they were ready to sit for them. Without their witch stones," I added.
"And they failed?"
Dara asked, noting their downcast manner with confusion.
"Failed?"
I snorted. "They had near-perfect scores on the written examination, and passed all of their oral and practical exams with highest marks," I said proudly. "Master Hartarian was nearly concerned with cheating, they did so well. But their performances in other areas convinced him and his staff that my apprentices apparently really have mastered their craft."
"Mastered might be overstating it,"
Rondell said guiltily.
"So, you aren't Master Minolin's apprentices anymore?"
Dara asked, shocked.
"No, but you are,"
Tyndall reminded her with a smile.
"Senior and only at the moment."
"Then why are you so despondent?"
she asked, confused.
"Because now they have to be their own men,"
Pentandra chuckled, "and that is a very frightening thing for a man to face. Following orders is easy, compared to figuring out what to do on your own."
"So, what are you going to do, now that you're free men?"
Arborn asked, curious.
"Free might be overstating it,"
Tyndall said with a half-smirk, half-scowl, that only his face could manage. "We got our journeyman's papers, but were still sworn knights magi of the Baron of Sevendor."
"Of course, since you've rendered good service to me for the last few months, I'd say your feudal obligation is fulfilled, for now. Which returns us to the question. What do you plan to do?"
"We've been talking about that, actually," considered Tyndall. "Ron and I are going to go back to Estazi Hall for a little while to take care of a few things there. But then we plan on travelling down into Lower Alshar. The rebellious part," he reminded me.
"Good gods! Why?"
asked Pentandra.
"I can think of thousands of other places I'd go if I were you two. We have some unfinished business with the Brotherhood of the Rat,"
answered Tyndall,
in a low voice. We're going to track down a couple of them and make them squeal. We're concerned that they're working with the Gavani now, and we have other reasons to hunt them. And there's a kid from there we want to look up, added Rondal. A sport or raw talent,